like to welcome everyone here to the Second Court of Appeals this afternoon, and we appreciate your being here. It's my understanding that the attorneys have all checked in. We have two cases that will be argued today at 1:30. And before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to everyone. To my left is Justice Mark Pittman, and to my right is Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Chief Justice Bonnie Sutterth. Before we begin the first argument, would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call Bertrand Baptist Church versus Scarlett Rafferty Ellis as the personal representative of the estate of Sean Christian Rafferty, Scarlett Rafferty Ellis individually, and Sean Paul Rafferty individually. May it please the court, Randall Smith to argue for the appellant, Sean Hester to argue for the appellant.
You may begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, this case is a declaratory judgment case to determine the proper beneficiary of a $100,000 life insurance policy. Policy was the separate property of a Mr. Sean C. Rafferty, who's deceased, and I'll refer to as Mr. Rafferty. It was granted to him as his separate property in a divorce decree issued by Judge Randy Catterton out of the 231st District Court here in Tarrant County in 2010. It granted ownership to Mr. Rafferty of the life insurance policy, conditioned by Judge Catterton to require that Mr. Rafferty designate his two then minor children as the only beneficiaries of that life insurance policy. Those two children were his daughter Scarlett, then 17, and his son Sean, then 15 or 16. Scarlett and Sean are the appellees in this appeal. By June of 2013, Sean and Scarlett were both over 18 and out of high school, and Scarlett was married. Neither lived any longer with Mr. Rafferty. Mr. Rafferty lived as a single man. He was retired from the military and from the insurance business. He was, however, active in Birchman Baptist Church and worked part-time doing yard work and repairs for the church and for widows helped by the church. On June 24 of 2013, after Sean and Scarlett were no longer minors or in possession or subject to the orders of the 2010 divorce decree, Mr. Rafferty changed the beneficiary of his life insurance policy to name his church, Birchman Baptist Church, as the sole and irrevocable beneficiary of that policy. The next day, Mr. Rafferty died by suicide. Mr. Rafferty had left the life insurance policy and change of beneficiary designation in a sealed envelope with the church CFO, who placed it in the church safe. After learning of Mr. Rafferty's death, the envelope was unsealed and the church became aware of Mr. Rafferty's actions to leave the proceeds of his life insurance to the church. The church filed notice of its claim with Bankers Life and Casualty Company, and shortly thereafter, Sean and Scarlett also filed a claim with Bankers Life and Casualty on the basis that their claim that the divorce decree said they should have remained the beneficiaries. Sean and Scarlett then filed their first declaratory judgment suit in Denton County in the County Court of Law Number 2, naming Bankers and Birchman as defendants. Bankers agreed to put the policy proceeds, which were approximately $86,000, into the court registry, and it was dismissed from the lawsuit. After the first declaratory judgment was filed, suit was filed, it proceeded normally, resulting in cross motions for summary judgment. The Denton County Court of Law entered summary judgment orders that declared under the Declaratory Judgment Act that provisions of the divorce decree that required Mr. Rafferty to name Sean and Scarlett as the beneficiaries of the life insurance policy were no longer binding on Mr. Rafferty after Sean and Scarlett became emancipated adults. And secondly, that as a result of Mr. Rafferty's beneficiary designation, that the Birchman Baptist Church was the proper beneficiary of the life insurance policy. Both of those were decided on summary judgment after full presentation of briefs and arguments. Those declaratory judgment summary judgment orders were entered in May and September of 2014, less than a year after the case was filed. However, in response to the entry of those summary judgment orders, the appellees amended their pleadings to add numerous tort claims and ultimately to seek damages in the amount of $1 million, intentionally well beyond the jurisdiction of the Denton County Court of Law. In fact, the appellees never prevailed on any of those tort claims, all of them being dismissed by summary judgment by either the County Court of Law or the 393rd. And the appellees never made a showing of any monetary damages above the $86,000 of insurance proceeds that were and are still in the registry of the court. However, during that time, the County Court of Law became concerned about its own jurisdiction since it did not have jurisdiction to hear divorce cases, and it ultimately refused to enter a final judgment. The appellees filed a new lawsuit in the 431st in Denton County with the same declaratory judgment request and the same tort claims. Appellee Scarlett, as executor of her father's estate, filed yet another lawsuit in the 393rd, also with the same declaratory judgment request and more tort claims, now adding the church pastor and CFO as defendants. All of those tort claims were likewise ultimately dismissed by summary judgment by the 393rd. And Birchman, during the last 4 years, has been trying to finalize the declaratory judgment orders entered in its favor in the original declaratory judgment action in the County Court of Law.
Can I stop you, Mr. Schmidt?
Hey.
There's no dispute here, is there, that the language in the divorce decree in paragraph H9 is ambiguous, is there?
I would respond to that, Your Honor, that in fact the parties continually stated that it was unambiguous. Did you say ambiguous or unambiguous?
Well, either one. My understanding from reading both the briefs is that both parties contend that this language is unambiguous. Is that correct?
That is correct.
If this language is unambiguous, my understanding would be something that this court can review de novo and can interpret as a matter of law. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Is there any need for this court, when we interpret this provision, to consider all the various jurisdictional arguments that have been set forth, the various ping-ponging from the courts? At the end of the day, why isn't the only issue we need to look at is paragraph H9? If both parties contend it's unambiguous and we can interpret it as a matter of law, why does this other stuff matter for us?
Honor, you're stealing my fire, but that is exactly the case. The controlling issue in this case is simply the issue of the application of the law and the jurisdictional limits on any divorce court hearing marital property, division, or child custody, the limits on their ability to include matters in a divorce decree. And as a matter of law, when you read the provision that you cited, it's clear that it simply conditioned Mr. Rafferty's ownership of the life insurance policy on making the children the beneficiaries of that policy, which again, as a jurisdictional limit, it could only do to be effective as long as they were minors. I would say further, excuse me, that the issue of the jurisdiction of the County Court of Law, I agree, is ultimately not important, because the 393rd raised that issue saying that because the court did not have jurisdiction to hear divorce cases, that it could not interpret the provision. And as you said, there is no interpretation of this provision that's required. All that is required is to apply the law. There are a number of issues before this court raised by the appellants, but the primary and controlling one is exactly that. Whether the divorce decree vested the plaintiffs with a right to the insurance proceeds, which continued after the plaintiffs reached adulthood. The answer to that is clearly no, and it's no as a matter of law. Texas courts hearing divorce cases involving division of marital property have no authority to award any part of the community property to anyone other than the spouses who are the parties to the divorce.
Now, let me stop you right there, Mr. Schmidt. Aren't there cases out there, and there's a case from the Dallas court from 1951, my memory escapes me, but it makes a difference between ownership interest and beneficiary interest. Why wouldn't the argument be that this is not actually conveying ownership of the life insurance policy itself, it's merely conveying beneficiary ownership in the life insurance policy?
Very good question, Your Honor. And the answer is that the right to designate a beneficiary is one of the important ownership elements of a life insurance policy. Without that right, the ownership is really pretty meaningless. So the actually the request that the appellees seemed to have made and relied upon was that they should have been retained as the beneficiaries. You'll notice that the 393rd in the judgment that we claim was erroneous actually went further and said it gave them a vested right in the proceeds. So exactly the question. Either case, the 393rd's judgment is erroneous because it equated the right to be determined the beneficiary as giving a vested interest in the proceeds. And that would be my answer to your question. They are both an ownership interest in the policy and therefore property of the marital estate.
Okay, let me ask you a hypothetical. What's the difference in giving the beneficiary interest in a life insurance policy in a divorce decree versus a divorce decree that requires the parents to pay for the minor's college education when they achieve majority?
Huge difference. A divorce decree tried to a court and issued by a court under its jurisdiction under the family court, family code, excuse me, cannot contain that provision. The only time that a party can be required to pay benefits of any type for support, college education, or you can go on down the line, living expenses.
Would be either agreed divorce decree or a settlement, correct?
It would have to be a divorce decree that incorporated a property settlement agreement, which is not the case here. If you look at the decree here, it's clearly tried to Judge Catterton. It's only signed by the lawyers and only as to form. It's clear from reading Judge Catterton's letter to the attorneys prior to creating this decree that all of the issues were tried to him and decided by the court. So the difference is, as you say, the limit on the court's jurisdiction toward that is clear under Section 7.001 of the Family Code, which only gives the court the right to order a division of the estate of the parties. And the case that we've cited to this court, and I will tell you, it was difficult to find law on this, much to my surprise, but the case of Treadway versus Treadway has never been changed, as far as I know, and there's been no case cited by the appellees to change this general rule. And that court set out that although the judgment before it there was interlocutory, it says, we note that it is erroneous in at least one respect, and it purports to divest the title to community property from both of the spouses who own it and vest the fee title thereto in the children of the parties, a procedure which is not permitted in a proceeding between only the spouses and involving only the divorce, child custody, and partition of the community estate, which was exactly the situation in the Rafferty divorce. The second jurisdictional limitation that applies as a matter of law is that a court hearing a child custody and support case can, in fact, set aside or condition property for the support of the children during of the marriage. But it cannot order that support or those benefits to continue after the children or the child reaches 18, graduates from high school, or is otherwise emancipated.
So you're treating this like child support? Because it occurs to me when I read the order that I can't remember if it was 30 days or 15 days, but 30 days when he had to make the change of beneficiary to the life insurance policy.
Which he did.
But there's nothing that says he had to keep it that way, and it's silent as to whether until they turn 18. There's nothing in there that says he couldn't change it to somebody else 2 years later. So are you just trying to draw an analogy between child support, which that cuts off at 18 as a matter of law, or is there some legal authority out there that says in these circumstances it goes until they're 18?
Appellant's position, Your Honor, is that as a matter of law, this can obviously not be a grant of a property interest. So what was it? Well, it conditions his ownership of the property by requiring that. But I agree with you. It doesn't even require that he keep the policy in effect or continue to make premium payments. The
How
only
does it condition
the reason we say
it?
That is only because that is the meaning it must have, because it can't actually vest an interest as a 319.
That's as much of a meaning as it must have, is that it has to, it, at most, it's 18, is your position.
It has to have some meaning, and that has to be what it is under the law.
How does it condition it? You said that twice now, and I'm looking at it, and I don't see, I see the word, the banker's life and casualty company life insurance policy number, subject, and then the rest of the sentence makes no sense. Subject to the on this policy, period. And then it is ordered that Sean Rafferty, I don't see that that award of that insurance policy is conditioned on anything. He's ordered to do it, and he did it.
Exactly, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I was probably using it not clearly enough. He was granted the policy as separate property. No issue. He has all of the ownership. He was then ordered to make them the beneficiaries. And we, our position is that could only have been in effect while they were children, and therefore, once they became emancipated adults, Mr. Rafferty was, in fact, free to change the beneficiary designation.
Because it's a type of child support.
Because it's a provision that would effectively allow them to have money if Mr. Rafferty were to die before they became adults.
Okay. Thank you.
My time's up. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. I want to start with the divorce decree, and we actually did some oral argument exhibits, which I have included in a binder, which hopefully you have. The one thing, there's a couple of things that I want to point out with regard to the divorce decree itself. First of all, there is no language in the divorce decree that sets the time as only until the children turn 18. That's being read into it by the appellants. And basically what they're saying is, because the court couldn't do it, they didn't do it.
Could he have canceled the policy?
Well, interestingly,
could he have canceled the policy and then taken another policy?
According to the order itself, yes. I believe the letter that Mr. Schmidt was referring to actually had a prohibition against canceling the policy, but it didn't make it to the order. So according to the order itself, he could have canceled it. He borrowed against it. There's a couple of things that I want to make clear about it. Number one, it was community property that was given to Mr. Rafferty in the divorce decree, and it was given to him. He was not ordered, Mr. Rafferty was not ordered to pay support.
That's because he had primary possession of the children, correct?
That's okay. Correct. Mr. Rafferty Mrs. Rafferty, I'm sorry, was ordered to pay the support. And so if you look at the decree, it's clearly in the property division. And what it is, it's giving community property, life insurance policy, to Mr. Rafferty. And it's requiring that Mr. Rafferty name only the children, his children, as the beneficiaries. So
is there anything in the plain language of H-9 that says that once they were named as beneficiaries under the policy that Sean C. could not go back and name another beneficiary?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is because it said
where's that in the language?
Only the children can be named the beneficiary. To find otherwise would make it meaningless. If he could change the beneficiary within 30 days, 31 days, change it back, it would be meaningless.
And you contend this provision is unambiguous, correct?
Correct.
I'll ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Schmidt. If this is unambiguous, it's something that can be interpreted as a matter of law, does this court need to go into, in its opinion, one way or another, do we need to address all the jurisdictional issues, the ping-ponging between the various courts, whether the county court can do something affecting the divorce decree? Does any of that matter for our analysis at the end of the day?
Well, actually, no, it does not. And there's a very simple reason that it doesn't matter. There was no dismissal in the county court at law number 2. It was transferred. When it was transferred,
At the end of the day, we still have a final order from a court that had competent jurisdiction to determine this issue. Is that correct?
It was interlocutory. This court found that it was interlocutory. We appealed
from the county court.
We appealed from the county court at law number 2. This court found that the summary judgment orders were interlocutory because they didn't dispose of attorney's fees, didn't account for distribution. So the court found that it was interlocutory. And there is one little red herring here that I want to address. I believe the appellants have said at one point we didn't appeal the right order. What we appealed was the final order, which we understood the county court at law too had issued a bunch of orders, and he was trying to do a finalize it and did a final order, and we appealed the final order. But it's clear in our docketing statement, which I've included in our exhibits, that we were appealing the adverse summary judgment naming the beneficiaries. So what happened is this court found that it was interlocutory, sent it back to the county court at law number two. County court at law number two then, with the agreement of the district court, transferred it. So any jurisdictional issues would no longer exist. I mean, that it was transferred as an interlocutory order. So there is an adverse summary judgment to us. The only way that can be changed is if it's altered. The 393rd altered it, because that became the trial court. There was the order never became final. And if you find that the order became final at some point, then that would effectively prevent us from ever being able to appeal that adverse order. So that,
regardless, it's tortured history. One way or another, it's teed up as a matter of law for this court to decide.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And it's out of the 393rd. But let me go back to the decree. First of all, I do want to answer your question. The plain language of the order says that the only people that can be the beneficiary of that policy are the children. So for the life
of
that
it policy, says that he can only designate.
Name them. Okay. I apologize.
Okay.
Correct. So the only people that can be named beneficiaries of that policy are the children. And there's no limitation.
It doesn't really say that either. No. It just says that he's ordered to make the two children the only beneficiaries.
Right.
It doesn't go on and say, and they have to stay that way. It has to stay that way till they're 18. It just says you're going to do that within 30 days.
Well, Your Honor, and again, I go back to, I think that it is implied in there because of the word only. And if you read it any other way, then it would be meaningless because he could have changed the beneficiary the next day. What it is, it's error. If the court could not do that, then the court committed error. The divorce court committed error.
Well, you're not appealing that.
No, that was the divorce decree became a final judgment. The parties to the divorce decree had the right to appeal that judgment. They did not. The judgment became final. It's a final unappealed order.
Well, and following up on the question that Justice Sutterth was asking, so it doesn't say that you can't change it. So the cases that you relied on, the many times in your brief, were Box, Lackey, I believe, and there was a third one. But each of those cases are highly distinguishable, are they not, Mr. Hester?
I would say that Box involved an agreement. I believe Lackey is closer.
But Box not only, that's what you said in your brief, is that Box was different because it involved an agreement, but also in Box, the language in the document said that the beneficiaries could not be changed except with consent of both parties. That's a huge difference from our case, is it not? It specifically said the only way you can change it is if both parents agree.
I would agree that that language is not in our decree.
And don't you think it's necessary if you want to enforce it in that manner, that language be in there and it be specific?
I would say no.
Why would you imply one way or the other as to, I mean, it's silent as to whether he could cancel the insurance policy, stop making premium payments, or, like I said, in 45 days, change it to someone else?
I do think it's silent as to whether he had to keep it in effect. I do not think it's silent as to whether or not he could name anybody other than the children as beneficiary, because I do believe that he was required to name only the children as a beneficiary, which the converse of that is that he could not name anybody other than the children as a beneficiary.
Within the 30 days?
Well, I think the time period was when it had to be done in relation to making sure that it didn't drag out.
And it didn't say this shall stay in effect till the children reach the age of 18?
Nor did it say that it shall stay in effect until they're, you know, until they're however old when somebody dies, forever.
Well, and the Lackey case said, agreed that the understanding and agreement is binding not only on respondent, but his heirs, executors, and assigns forever.
Yes, Your Honor.
A big difference from the facts of our case, is it not?
I would agree that our divorce decree is lacking language with regard to the timing. I think it's more reasonable to read it as not having a limitation on the time, as basically for the children's lives, than to put in a provision that it stopped at 18, because it was not a child support provision.
Well, I don't think we have to put in a provision that it stopped at 18. All we have to say is that there was no requirement that he, once he designated them within 30 days of that decree, he complied with what was required of him.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I would take it a step further. And he's also ordered not to name anybody other than the children as beneficiary, because it says only.
If he had done that, if he had, on the 45th day, he had redesignated someone else.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could he have been held in contempt?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Or
going back to the Tomlinson versus Lackey case.
Why do you say that he could be held in contempt?
Well, because I think that, according to the Tomlinson versus Lackey case, I think that created an equitable interest on behalf of the children, and it's clear that the court wanted the children to be named the beneficiary in the policy. So,
under the language in that case.
Well, no, I'm not using the Lackey language as far as that goes. I think the divorce court clearly wanted the children to be the beneficiaries of that life insurance policy. So if he had changed it to the children 30 days and changed it back 45 days later, absolutely, I think there would have been a motion for contempt, and or I think the children would have had a right to sue, candidly, to say that they were the true beneficiaries and that couldn't be changed. Otherwise, again,
because they have an interest in it.
They have a vested future interest in that policy. That's what Tomlinson versus Lackey says. And then going back to what's the effect of that, it's error. If the court could not order that policy be kept in the children's name forever, then it was error. Well, error has to be appealed, and it has to be appealed by the parties involved in the divorce. And that's Shanks versus Treadway. That's the Supreme Court case, which basically says a final judgment has to be appealed. It cannot be collaterally attacked. And I'll tell you the exact words. Shanks versus Treadway. Notwithstanding the state of the law at the time the divorce decree was entered, this case does not involve a direct appeal, and we must interpret the decree to determine not what the trial court should have done, but, if possible, what the court actually did. So we have to look at what the court actually did and interpret it that way. And the courts can't change the property division once it becomes final.
Well, so that's why this is a de novo review of what H-9 means, like Justice Pittman started out saying, isn't it? I mean, we don't go off on the collateral attack rabbit trail, do we?
No, you don't, because it can't be collaterally attacked. And I guess that's the point that we're making, is since it cannot be collaterally attacked, then we have to look at it as written.
It says what it says.
It says what it says.
But it also doesn't say what it doesn't say.
That's true, Your Honor. That's true. So, anyway, just not to belabor the point, It's our position that it does say that only the children can be named the beneficiary. That's our reading of it.
I know you're about to I want to ask you this before you finish up, and I do apologize for interrupting you.
No.
There's an alternative argument out there that one of the that you asserted that did not appear to be addressed by any of the courts, and that's that the transfer to the Birchman Baptist Church never went into effect due to the timing. That was never addressed by any of the courts here. Is that correct?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor.
What effect does that have on our review?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure if it has an effect on your review or not. What it does have an effect on is that because the transfer of the beneficiary wasn't done correctly, it was never done, it was never completed. And the insurance company, the life insurance company, took the position that it belonged to the children for that reason, not for all these other reasons that we're arguing here today. So it's obvious that he was under duress at the time that he changed the beneficiary designation, and there were certain requirements like submit the divorce decree that he did not meet. And because of that and the timing, I believe that policy was actually never, the beneficiary was never changed before he passed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the Court again.
Would you address that last point that he made?
Yes, I was going. Are you talking about the duress point or the
That it wasn't effective?
I was going to object to the whole point about duress. That's not in this case. The point about the timeliness of the change of beneficiary designation, I'll point out to Your Honors that the Bankers Life people did get conflicting notices and originally said they didn't think that it was timely. We contacted them, wrote them a letter, and pointed out to them that the policy itself on page 3 said that the change will take effect on the date the request was signed, but it will not apply to payments made by the company before the request was received. So the request, this issue was addressed by the county court at law, and there was never a finding that the change of beneficiary form was not effective. It was, in fact, effective under the policy. Now, I do want to point out that really what we have here, in our opinion, is that the appellees are confusing a couple things. One is they are thinking that even though we have an unambiguous provision, that they can interpret it. We think it means this. We think only means permanent. That, in my opinion, as I think you all have stated, is not accurate and not the proper review. The review is the application of the law to that provision as written. Second, although probably not necessary, the point about there's a confusion about whether or not the orders of the county court at law were final or interlocutory. Clearly they were interlocutory. As we all know, Judge Ramirez refused to ever file a summary final judgment, and basically appellants had no way to proceed with this thing other than to take it to some court and try to get it resolved. It was not a final judgment, so we did not believe it was appropriate for this court to review. However, under the Supreme Court cases of Hyundai and Newco, very clear that those summary judgment orders in favor of the appellant church should have had a binding effect not only on the appellees but on the 393rd, because they were orders that were made in due course and with due process, and it was entirely the activities of the appellees following the entry of those orders that caused that court to lose jurisdiction ultimately over the remainder of the case. There's a lot to read in this case, but among other things you will see that Judge Ramirez clearly said that he did not intend to dismiss or strike or void his summary judgment orders on declaratory judgment, and that he intended them to have the full effect allowed by law. Now, I will agree, he didn't know what that effect was, but he clearly stated that was his intent, and I believe the Hyundai and NUCO cases say that should be in effect. In my opinion, that's just a second reason that the judgment of the 393rd needs to be reversed. I think this court should render judgment that Bankers is in fact the proper beneficiary. We would also ask the court to reverse the findings of attorney's fees and litigation expenses, which we didn't get to the point of discussing, and remand the case for the 393rd to consider whether or not it's appropriate to award attorney's fees and costs to the appellants. Thank you very much, Your Honors. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we appreciate your arguments. It's been very helpful to us. We thank you for coming this afternoon and presenting. You're now free to leave if you'd like. We've got another case that'll be argued. If you'd like to stay and listen to that, you're free to do that as well.